The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes. Oops, oops, oops.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I am Rick Welch, and behind the glass is Rocket Man Andy Bishop. This is part two of Andy's birthday, where he steps on cats.
Yes. Hopefully not again, but you never know. I like to keep it fresh.
Yeah. I went in to use your lavatory, Andy, and the cat scratched on the door the entire time. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry. So I opened the door, and then the cat just looked at me like, that's better.
Rhodey, that's that fat tabby
yes.
cat. He just wants to come into the bathroom while you're using the bathroom and hang out.
That's fine.
What do you want?
Should be
pet, maybe.
I should have let him.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to stand and pee in.
This one's Mai Tai. There's only the one. That is Mai Tai.
Yes, and you just heard the voice of our guest, Kirsten Barton.
Hey.
Glad you're back.
Glad to be here.
We took a 10-minute break, but for you, it was a week. The listener. So,
time travel.
Yes. So where we were, I was getting ready to go into the hot seat, which is pretty much where I've been for the past several months. I've been in the hot seats with all kinds of people. Bring it. What you got?
How does God pray to God? How does God have a God?
So when you're talking about Jesus, mm-hmm. whenever he goes up on the mountain and he prays all night, mm-hmm. and okay, so here's the way that I take it, all right? And it's in the book of Hebrews. Let's pull up the book of Hebrews.
Stacy Turbeville would school you right now.
He's not going to school me. I know Stacy Turbeville. He's a brilliant man. He's
brings
also
up
Unitarian.
Really great points.
Yeah, of course he does.
I have a quippy answer.
What's that?
It's called thinking.
There you go. You do it all the time. You do it all the time.
Reports might be exaggerated.
Have you ever had conflicting thoughts in your own brain?
Every day.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you do that? Imago Dei. Do you know what that means?
No.
Image of God. Huh. Wasn't that fun? What's your next problem? No, I'm just kidding. I haven't even thought.
All right.
All right. So one of the things that Hebrews says is that he thought it not robbery to be equal with God, right? Have you ever heard that?
That's Philippians.
No, that is Philippians. Very good.
You gotta be sharp.
Was that Philippians 2?
Be sharper than that.
Philippians 2?
Yes. 2, I think it's
2:13.
6 through
No. Let's just go to Philippians. You're right, it is Philippians. But I do need to go back to Hebrews because I need to show you something in Hebrews that I'm thinking about. All right, Philippians 2, we say. Let's see here. You just quoted it right off the bat. You don't know where it is exactly?
I said Philippians 2:6. Start there.
You're right. Philippians 2:6. All right.
Say that again.
You're right. I say that all the time, bro. I'm around a lot of people that are right. Verse 4, I'll start with, let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Now, I'm not even going to try to answer that the way that Stacy Turbeville would answer it, but I'll say it like this. He was in the form of God. Now, they might say he's in the form of a God, as a deity, but not divine as the Father. That's how they'll say it. But the Bible just said that he was in the form of God and thought it not robbery to be equal with him. So what does that mean? Well, if you want to put him on the same level as a Satan adversary who wanted to be the level of God, you could say he's the same level as like a morning star or the day star, like he's one of the stars. And so he would be the first created being, and everything after that, including Satan, was made by him, right? That's how a Unitarian has to take it, because the very first thing that was made was Christ in a Unitarian mind. So that means every other thing after that was made by him. Now, according to Christ, all things were made by him. All things were made by him, right? There was no thing that was not made by him. That's John.
now
him referring to God, correct?
Yes, the word.
See, on the flip side of that, like the other argument would be, it's talking about the covenant and like that's a covenant creation theme.
That's
not,
fine.
Not necessarily physical material creation, but I'm not fully decided on that.
No, that's fine, and you can say it's covenant.
Yeah.
Go for it, because covenant. Technically speaking, if you're reading it strictly from a covenant perspective, the ultimate goal is that the covenant is settled in the end, right? If it's not about the material universe and it's about covenant only, then it's all resolved.
Yeah.
So my point with this is that he was in the form of God, but did not see the equality of God being something. He emptied himself. What does that mean?
So I think Jesus has a role.
Okay.
And he is a servant, and he plays the role of the servant who does the will of the Father, but he's still deity.
So not God. Is that what you're saying? Like, we're talking from a Unitarian perspective.
I'm not Unitarian.
I'm not saying that you are.
Okay.
We're having a conversation.
Right.
As it stands right now, I'm a Trinitarian. You are currently...
Undecided.
Undecided. Okay. Mm-hmm. So at this level, you're undecided. And we're just having a talk. We're speculating here. That's what we're doing.
I see both views, and I think there's really, they make really good arguments on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm undecided.
Yeah, I understand. So whenever Jesus becomes a man, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you can look at it, let's look at it from the Unitarian perspective.
Okay,
so he's deity, and so he empties himself of his deity. Is that true?
No.
Then what does he empty himself of?
He doesn't come to earth and say, I'm God. Like, I'm God Almighty.
Mm-hmm.
He is very low-key about who he is.
Right, but let's stick with the emptying here.
Okay. I'm trying to.
Okay. All right, you're good.
You know, like, God is an all-consuming fire, you know?
Okay.
In the Old Testament, like, he consumed people. He opened up the earth and swallowed them. So Jesus came as a humble, lowly servant of God.
Mm-hmm. But didn't empty himself of deity. He just emptied himself of what? Pride? Which he didn't have.
I know.
So what is he emptying himself of? Because it's pretty safe to say that even as a man, he was doing things that were supernatural.
Oh, yeah.
So he empties himself, but what is he emptying himself of? It's right there. It tells you. Equality.
Equality.
He empties himself of the equality.
Okay.
He's emptying himself as the role of the servant, as the role of the son. He's emptying himself of that nature, of that equality, in order to be subject. He's becoming a subject, right?
Right.
He was higher than all of the angels.
Right.
Higher than all the messengers, whatever you want to call them, angelos.
Yeah.
He's higher than all of them. So you could say, well, he's the number one highest deity in the pantheon of gods, if that's what you want to say. I see it as he's emptying himself of the equality. Now, men, when Jesus would say certain things, they would look at him and say, this is blasphemy. He's making himself equal with God. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, a Unitarian will argue that point all day long and say, that's not what it means. It's not, it doesn't mean that. It's because of this. It's a man who's mistaken. He doesn't understand it fully. And that's why, fine, whatever. My point is that Jesus keeps making the point always that he is the eternal one. He's the eternal one.
He's the Son of God.
He's the eternal one.
Right.
Does eternity have a beginning?
No.
I mean, to me, it seems, look, the Trinity is, to me, now I've met a lot of people that can explain it better than me, but trying to define the Trinity is very difficult. I've heard people use water as a way to do it. Have you ever seen that or heard that?
No.
They call water the fingerprint of God because water exists in three states. So you have solid, liquid, and gas. So the solid would be Jesus, the liquid would be God, and then the gas would be the Spirit kind of idea.
Yeah.
So each one of them have a distinct quality. It's still the same thing. It's always still water.
I like that.
But it operates in different ways.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Because if God is spirit, then what's the Holy Spirit? So Jehovah's Witnesses will say, it's not God either. They'll say the Holy Spirit is a separate active force. That's the word that they use for it. Okay?
Right.
They make these distinctions. And then the Son is a created being, the firstborn of all creation, the first thing, right? Firstborn doesn't mean physical birth. Firstborn means heir of all things. It means he is the one and that's at the right hand. He's heir.
Did Jesus spiritually die on the cross?
I think he died spiritually before his physical death.
Mm-hmm. Separation from the Father?
Forsaken. What does forsaken mean? He's quoting from the psalmist, but what is he saying? My God, why have you forsaken me? What does forsaken mean? What does it mean?
Say separated.
Sounds like Adam to me.
Yeah.
Now, when he's baptized, what does the Father say?
This is my beloved Son.
Yeah. Then later on, when he's at the Transfiguration, what does the Father say?
This is my beloved Son.
And he says, hear him.
Hear him. Hear ye him.
When Jesus cries out to him on the cross, do you hear the Father say a word? You would think that he would, but what happens? He makes the Son go dark.
Yeah.
What's happening is that God is resolving the problem. He's solving the problem, and it's within himself.
Of separation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But people don't want to, people think it's all physical, and I just don't think it's just physical, something going on that cross.
The separation of God, first of all, when as a full preterist, you've probably heard that death existed, like physical death existed.
That's what I believe.
Yeah, prior to. Yeah. And that death has always been the thing in humanity, right?
Yeah.
And I came from a fundamentalist background that's very physical, believing that mm-hmm. death didn't enter the world until Adam made of it. And there was no other person that was born, until Adam, everything came from Adam. Whereas, they kind of put together Genesis 1 and Genesis 2.
Yeah.
Genesis 2 is more like a hyper-focus on Genesis 1.
Yeah.
Which is completely out of order and very odd. It's, you can't actually reconcile the two with a physical way. You can't do it that way. It has to be covenantal. But
right, because they were different origin stories written at different times.
And we talked about it. We've talked about it in here how many times. I always say, so man was lonely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Man was lonely. And so God wanted to resolve that problem. And so what did he do to resolve that problem?
He sent Christ to die on the cross.
No, I mean in Genesis, whenever it says that Adam was lonely. So how did he solve the problem?
Oh, sorry. It's okay. Different problem.
Cloning.
He created the woman.
Yeah, that's what everybody always says.
Yeah.
That's not what it says.
Right.
He made made animals.
Oh, that's right.
He made the animals.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the first thing he does is make the animals. Yeah. Now, if you go to Genesis 1, the animals are already made, and then he makes the male and female. But in Genesis 2, it says the man is made, and then he makes the animals and brings them to him, and then he names them, right?
Okay.
And then some people are like, well, those are the animals that are on a farm. Those are the animals that,
Yeah.
That are the beasts of burden that work for them. They'll say, I don't see that in the words.
So first he made the crocodiles, and then later he made cats.
First he made the crocodiles, and then he made the donkeys, because donkeys would do the work on the farm.
What about the dinosaurs?
What about them?
He just put those bones in the earth to test your faith.
I have actually heard that before.
That's why I'm covenant creation, because I believe the Bible is silent about dinosaurs besides Leviathan and Behemoth or whatever. But we're going off onto so many tangents. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm an old earth guy. And so I think that the dinosaurs absolutely lived on the earth.
Yeah, me too.
And I think they lived on the earth prior to man.
But I mean, I don't believe it. For me, I don't believe the Bible talks about it. I believe it's before Genesis.
Oops, I mean, it's quite possible. I mean, I don't, I agree. I don't think it talks about it at all.
Yeah.
Now, Ken Ham would differ. I think he has David riding a dinosaur in one of his pictures, which is weird.
Oh, okay. Are you serious? This is amazing. I need it.
During the Ice Age.
I need this in my life.
That doesn't sound biblical.
I'll get you a picture. I'll get you a picture. It's pretty neat.
You remember, what was it? Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, and yes. Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies.
Oh my gosh, yes. I forgot about
Remember
that.
Remember that author? Yeah. I need somebody to like maybe do that with the Bible and dinosaurs. whoever that guy is, call him up.
I've always wanted to watch that movie, Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, actually. My son loves that movie. I haven't watched it yet.
I've never seen it. I read the book.
Oh, is it good?
It didn't live up to the hype. Yeah. But apparently, like, wildly historically accurate, you know, except for the vampires.
Yeah.
So.
Sure.
Interesting. They just, yeah, how he did that. I think it's a commendable and interesting work. It was a fine book. It was
right. Fine. Cool. All right. So we got off tangent.
Yeah.
So how does God pray to God? Well, because the Son has emptied himself of his equality, he has placed himself into subjection, even so far as subjection to a cross. Therefore, at his baptism, the Holy Spirit descends upon him, which means that as the Christ child, he's born and he grows, just like we all do, in wisdom and in stature. This is the kind of emptying that it seems that he's done. And so by the time he is ready to take on the ministry, the Holy Spirit comes down on them in the form of a dove, and the Father speaks from heaven, and that sets him on his journey and his ministry. And the first place he goes is to the God of this world. He goes right into the wilderness and goes right at the adversary. Okay. And he begins to bind the strong man, and he starts to plunder his house and all of those that are elect, and that's what he's doing. He's seeking the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and he's going to bring them all back.
And that's what I would love to talk about is, can we talk about the biblical storyline?
We can talk about anything you want.
I would love to tell you what God is showing me, like really putting emphasis on the biblical storyline.
Okay.
So I really got a good understanding with the kingdom divided story in the Old Testament.
Yeah, North and South.
Yeah.
Judah and Israel.
So Andy and whoever is listening out there. So Israel, they were one nation. And then during King Solomon's reign, he was disobedient. And he had like 900 girlfriends and wives.
700 wives, 300 concubines.
Wow.
And Thank they were all you. Mean. They were all mean.
They were all have the correct information out there. So God did not want him to be with all those women because they were foreign women. And if he went after—
pulling him into idolatry, right?
Yeah, pulling him after other gods. Like he would chase after his girlfriend's gods or his wife's gods because they're all idolatrous and they worship, you know, stones and trees and animals.
Those girls flung a hankering on him that he just couldn't get rid of.
So he had like 900 of those women. And because he was disobedient and he fell away from God, kind of. And because of that, God said that he was going to tear the kingdom from him, but he wasn't going to do it while he was alive. He was going to do it in his son's lifetime. So during his son, Rehoboam, during his lifetime, God tore the kingdom. He divided the kingdom of Israel. So it was the 10 northern tribes, and he gave them to Solomon's servant, Jeroboam. And then you have the division of Judah and Benjamin. That was the southern kingdom. So you have northern kingdom, southern kingdom. And he gave those two tribes to Rehoboam.
And the actual son.
Yeah, the actual son. I'm sorry if I'm confusing anyone. So God has been showing me this biblical narrative and this storyline. Well, one of the reasons that Jesus came was to restore the kingdom. And so a lot of people realize that it's a biblical narrative. And of course, Jesus came to die. But I would say first and foremost, he came for the Jews first. It talks about like to the Jew first, then to the Gentile. Well, he came to fulfill Israel's promises. And so the 10 northern tribes throughout the biblical storyline in the Old Testament, God divorced them. And like I have Hosea open right now. That's what the book of Hosea is about, where he divorces the 10 northern tribes because they're so far in idolatry.
Is this the same division that we were talking about like pretty recently here with the two nations? Is that the same division?
That's the same one.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the 10 northern tribes of Israel, they became pretty much like Gentiles. Like they, you know, and the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin, that's where the word Jew comes from, Judah. Those were God. I mean, they became God's special people, but they also fell into idolatry. And that's kind of what Jesus came to help to call out as well, as they fell away ultimately. And so the 10 northern tribes, they pretty much, they got taken into Assyrian captivity and they were scattered everywhere. And God divorces them in the book of Hosea and says, you know, these, you know, you are not my people anymore. But eventually, and this is what I want to get to, in Hosea 2:23, it says, and I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them which were not my people, you are my people. And they shall say, you are my God. So he divorces them, but says, eventually, I'm going to remarry you in the future. And that is what Christ came to do. And that's what I believe the marriage supper of the Lamb is about initially and primarily, is God remarrying. And, you know, whenever Peter, the apostles ask Jesus in the book of Acts, when will you restore the kingdom to Israel?
Yeah.
I believe the New Testament is all about the restoration of the kingdom of these two tribes that got divided in the Old Testament, and Jesus has come to restore them. Now you think of the prodigal son, and we can all apply that to our lives when we got saved. Mm-hmm. But I believe contextually that parable and a lot of the parables, and even the Luke 16 parable of the rich man and Lazarus, I believe this is like, you know, the northern tribes, they were kind of counted as Gentiles. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. They're seen very much like Gentiles, yes.
Right. So in the New Testament, when Jesus comes on the scene, you have the woman of Samaria at the well. Mm-hmm. So Samaria, that was a part of the northern kingdom.
It was the capital of the northern kingdom, yeah.
Yeah, so the woman of the well, she would have been like one of the, you know, the lost sheep. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, she would have probably been an elect person.
Well, she says something very unique. She tells Jesus at the well that she's at, she says, our father Jacob dug this well.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Well, for her to say our father Jacob, she's acknowledging that she's one of those in the tribes.
Right.
She's not an Assyrian that's living there in Samaria. She's right. One of the Israelites that's long been divorced from.
Yeah.
Who still had the Pentateuch, because the Pentateuch are the five books that are used in the northern tribes.
Yeah.
It's the Torah that's used in the southern kingdoms. So they still have the Pentateuch and they still believed in this God, and there is a righteous remnant that Jesus is going after. It's the lost sheep.
Yeah, and that's really what I wanted to touch down on, what God's really showing me in the scripture.
And that's what he's doing in Acts chapter 2.
Yeah.
In Acts chapter 2, all of those people that have been in the diaspora, that were assimilated into the other empires throughout time, they are all coming back for this feast. And when they get there for the Feast of Weeks, which is what we call Pentecost, those are all of the righteous remnant. They're the ones that are elect. They're the ones that God, you know, he saves 3,000 on that day that Peter speaks.
Yeah, they're from all these different nations.
Yeah, it tells you they're from everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's also the righteous remnant. But there's an order. Yes, he's restoring the actual kingdom, but we don't want to make the same mistake that Judas made. And that's what I think that Israel only does. They make the same mistake as Judas did, which is, I'm going to have a kingdom. You're going to restore the kingdom, and I'm going to be the treasurer of that kingdom because it's going to be a physical thing.
Right.
That's not what it was.
No, I'm not trying to go Israel only.
No. I was saying I'm not saying you are. Okay. I'm saying that's what Israel only does. And I think that's a mistake. They're thinking like Judas thinks. Judas believed in a physical, natural, you know, blood kingdom. And that's what he wanted. And he thought Jesus was that man that was going to bring it back. He truly believed that. But Jesus made it clear that we're going to a spirit kingdom.
See, it gets difficult because when you go to like Ezekiel 37 and we read about what we're talking about, there's land promises.
Yes.
So it gets really confusing. And I do understand why people, especially the Jews today, why they look for a physical kingdom and a physical Messiah. But Jesus said, you know, he said, The kingdom of God does not come with observation. Neither will men say, here it is, or look over there. And I feel like right there, that's the answer.
Yeah.
That there's not a physical kingdom.
Jesus told the woman at the well, speaking to one of the lost sheep that were out there in Samaria, he says, there's going to be a time where you will neither worship him on this mountain, where were they? Mount Gerizim. Or on that mountain, where was that? Mount Zion in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Neither place are you going to worship him. But you're going to, because God is seeking those who worship him in spirit and in truth. Mm-hmm. His kingdom is not of this world. The land promises are fulfilled in Christ.
That's correct.
It
He's
is
the land.
He is the promises.
Yes.
He's all of the promises.
Yeah. We enter, like you said, we enter the gates, and we enter through the gates through Christ.
Yes.
I mean, he said, I am the door.
That's right.
So that is how we get.
And the spirit and the bride say, come.
Yeah.
The spirit and the bride say, come.
Whosoever will.
The spirit and the bride say, come, and those who come in will be clean. Those who come in to wash their robes will be clean. Those are on the outside that are considered the unclean.
Yeah.
They're in outer darkness. They don't know until they're invited, right?
Right.
And then when you invite them and they come in, then they have access to the tree of life and they can have healing. And what is the point? So what does that mean for us? When the only thing that I can observe, if I can observe anything in another human being, is if I see the fruits of the Spirit. By their fruits, I will know them. And that's how I know. I can see them. When God's working love and patience and kindness and gentleness and faithfulness and self-control and, you know, these love, you know, this deep love for people, whether they're an enemy or not, it doesn't matter. When I see that fruit coming through somebody, that's the evidence that I'm looking for.
Yeah. And let me tell you, I feel like God is really blessing me with those fruits, and they're finally growing. But like, I was not growing under condemning preaching. And I'm not saying that it's coming, that it ever came from the church I went to.
It shows you the power of the mind.
But, you know, he's really showing me grace and helping me to understand it. Like, you know, I feel like an idiot. Like, you know, I've missed the forest because, you know, I'm not looking at the bigger picture of grace and what Christ came to do and what God. It's really simple. It's God offers you forgiveness through the gospel. You either accept it or reject it. And it's so simple. And I feel like I've overcomplicated it. And he's really growing me. And it's really, I feel like it's producing a lot of fruit.
Yeah. And I mean, if you ask, so that's another thing that fundamentalism really gets into us is this idea of forgiveness. I'm not saying that people don't need to be forgiven. That's not what I mean.
Yeah.
But I don't look at it the same way that I would as if I was a first century covenant breaker.
Oh, absolutely.
One of those people that need to be baptized, you know, in that regard. Whenever those who are on the outside, he says, and nothing unclean will ever enter into it, and there is no temple in it because it is God and the Lamb, then what it's saying is that, and those that are on the outside, they will come in, they will bring it into the kingdom, and then they will have access to these leaves that will heal them.
Yeah.
The healing of the nations. It's all of the nations, not just some of them, but all of the nations. Mm-hmm. So what you're doing in essence with the washing of the robes is becoming clothed in Christ. Sometimes when we hear the gospel, people want to go to that New Testament way of telling somebody, you need to go to the altar and you need to ask for forgiveness of your sin. Mm-hmm. That's what they're telling you.
Yeah.
See, that's not what I'm saying.
Right.
What I'm saying is that God is giving you this. Ask him. I'm telling you, come to him and receive it. Come and receive it.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. I'm not telling you that you're a dirty, rotten scoundrel.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, come and receive it because you need it. This is something that has changed my life for the better, and my life is abundant. It is abundant. And I have learned how to live with little and to live with much in this world. But I have joy.
Amen.
That is a fruit.
And it's about relationship. And I, you know, I got caught up in a works-based kind of thing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I'm just now slowly learning, like, it really is about relationship. And like, God, I need you. You know, I want to have a relationship with you, and I need you in my life.
Yeah.
I need you.
Whenever I talk to people about this kind of love, I always get the same approach from these fundamentalists, and this is what it is. Well, sometimes you got to have tough love. I hear that all the time. And I'm like, all right, man, have at it. Go be tough if you want. That's not the kind of love. Jesus says, I am meek and lowly. I am gentle. He had tough love on whom?
The religious.
Yeah, and people. Where did they go? By the way,
His they love got was destroyed in 70 AD.
His love was for the Father. Yeah. Jesus loved the Father.
Yes.
When he was in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was like, take this cup from me. What was that cup? The cup of what?
Wrath.
Take this cup of wrath from me. Mm-hmm. Take this cup from me. So, in other words, Jesus was saying, I don't want to do this for any of these people. That's what Jesus is actually saying.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to do this for these people because what's going to happen is what? I'm going to be forsaken. For the first time in all of eternity, I'm going to be forsaken by my Father. I don't care what anybody says. You can try to weasel out of that idea all you want. That is the biblical narrative.
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
I don't mean you. I mean people who are listening. And there are plenty that will argue with me about this. Have at it. Bring it. Send any email to rocketman@... Burzaberia.com.
Oh, yeah, I really need to check it.
Well, I keep saying it. Rocketman at really Burzaberia. If you got any problem with Rick, take it up with Andy.
That's right.
So,
well, can we talk about what that wrath was?
Sure. What was the wrath?
Well, that's why I'm asking you.
Sure. I mean, the wrath is all of the wrath that God is placing on that old covenant. All right. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just use one aspect of it. Jesus talks about it. Jeremiah talks about it. What were these people doing in idolatry? Okay. They were burning their children alive.
Mm-hmm.
They were burning their children alive.
In Gehenna.
Yeah. The Valley of Hinnom.
Yep.
So what does Jesus say? How can you escape that?
How can you escape the sentence of Gehenna?
How can you escape that eternal fire that's coming? How can you escape it? You cross land and sea and make one proselyte and turn him into twice the son of Gehenna than you are.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that was just one aspect. The evil nature that humanity has within it because of the good and evil that's in it, all of it separates you from God. All of your good, all the good you think you can do, all of the evil that you want to do separates you from God.
Mm-hmm.
That is the thing that separates you. The wrath is upon that. And you know what he did? He put it on himself. He poured all that wrath on his son in the physical realm.
People have asked me if you don't, so just for the audience, I do not believe in eternal conscious fiery torment, and neither does Rick. So people will ask me, well, what did Jesus die for? And, you know, what did he take on the cross? And, you know, I don't understand how that contradicts anything, but apparently for them it does.
Well, the idea is that, their idea is that, well, I have sin in my life, so therefore if I don't take what Jesus, like if I don't take what Jesus offered, Jesus didn't take the sin, he took the penalty of sin.
Right.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So sin still is here. That's what they'll say. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. What did John say that he was getting ready to do? Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Takes away the penalty of it.
Right.
He said takes it away. The sin. So to me, it's pretty simple. It's very simple. It's very difficult and hard to do. And it, you know, God did over thousands of years. But the idea that whatever it is that separated man from God is what Jesus is fixing.
Right.
Because in the end, at the end of Revelation 21 and 22, is we find ourselves back in that Garden City. So he's resolving that problem.
Right.
But does he solve the curse of the weeds on the ground, the thorns and thistles shall it bring? A covenant creationist will say that's a person. I'm saying that it's the effect of the physical reality in which we live. So if I say, okay, that hasn't changed, physical death hasn't changed. That's why futurists have a hope. And what they say is we need to receive Christ, ask for forgiveness for sins, receive Christ, wait on his soon coming, and then after that, there will be no more physical death. That's the hope of the futurist Christian. All right, so here's the deal. Lately, I've been getting these compliments like, wow, you really know how to cook. And I just smile and nod like, oh yeah, totally. I'm basically a pro. But behind the scenes, it's all thanks to my secret ingredient. So let me break it down for you. First up is everything seasoning. And this literally goes on everything. Chicken, perfect. Fish, yep. Veggies, next level. And one day, I got creative and sprinkled it on popcorn, and honestly, life-changing. Now everybody wants to come to my house to watch the movies. I also tried it on cottage cheese. Is that weird? Yep. Did I regret it? Also yep. But now, let's talk about Steakhouse. This isn't just seasoning, it's grill legend in a jar. You shake this on a steak and suddenly you become Buck. Who is Buck, you ask? He's the flannel-wearing, boot-stomping king of the barbecue pit. Buck chops down trees with his bare hands, grills a T-bone so good it'll make you want to slap Gordon Ramsay's mama right in the mouth. I grilled up some burgers with Steakhouse last weekend and my buddy took one bite and said, "Dude, can I please get this recipe?" I just told him it was my little secret. So if you want to look like a kitchen rock star and keep your secret weapon close, head to MySecretBlends.com. That's MySecretBlends.com. And use code Burrows at checkout for 20% off your first order. That's B-U-R-R-O-S at checkout to get 20% off of your first order. So shake it, serve it, and when they ask, just grin and say, "It's my little secret." My secret ingredient. Get yours today.
See, and Christ came to fix the spiritual problem, not a physical problem. I believe that the death on the cross, I believe him dying physically, I believe it all has to do with something spiritual, not physical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like a lot of us get so hyped up about, I'm going to get a new body and I'm so excited. And it's like we miss the boat. Like, well, it's really about eternal matters and spiritual. Who cares about a body?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I understand.
Well, and they wrestle with it because the Bible talks about a new body.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
You know, and so we see it as a corporate body.
But right.
There's some people think that it's going to be, you know, a new body. Gary DeMar said here in this podcast, you know, I believe that we got our soul returns to God and then we receive a new body.
Yeah. And that's okay. I totally understand because I've been there.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I believe what Jesus came to solve was something spiritual and eternal and more important than something physical.
It was the separation.
Yeah.
It was the relationship separation.
And that's way more important.
If you want to remain morally autonomous, like if you want to remain morally autonomous and start, you know, measuring good and evil in yourself and everyone else, you're doing nothing different than what Adam and Eve and everybody else dealt with in the world. You are literally doing the same thing. And what you're doing is you're believing that same old lie from a long deceased being, which was the serpent, whoever he was, that said, the only reason he doesn't want you to eat this is because you're going to become like him. Your eyes will be open and you're going to be like God and you're going to know both good and evil. And it was in that very moment in Eve's mind where that tree suddenly looked like a delight to her. And she saw that it was one that would make her wise. And so she ate of it. She gave to her husband and he ate of it. And immediately the things that Satan said would happen did.
Yeah.
They did. He didn't lie to them. People are like, he lied. No, he deceived them with a truth. That God didn't look at them and say, look, don't eat of that tree because in the moment that you eat of it, you're going to be like me and you're going to know the things that I know and I don't want you to know them because it's not necessary.
Yeah.
He didn't say any of that. He just said, don't. Well, Satan played the other side. That's what he does. He's the adversary. He's constantly going after that side of it. Like, hey, you know, I can, you know, you can be like him and you're going to know both. So then you can start making your own choices.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And so the problem that came from that very thing, and I tell everybody this, I'll tell Andy this too. Whether you believe that Adam and Eve were a real person or not, if you look at it just from a lesson perspective, just like even if you want to look at it in mythology, look at it in mythology. The reality here is that all it's teaching you is that your moral autonomy is what separates you from the thing that made you. That's what it's telling you. Your moral autonomy is what separates you from the thing that made you. So you can't relate to the thing that made you.
I mean, that's kind of awkward for me because I don't think anything made me, so I'm not under. I don't understand the.
No,
that
I said
way.
From a mythological perspective, not your okay. non-belief perspective. I mean, from a mythology perspective, what it's saying is that the thing that made him said, "Don't do this." Then there's this other character that's playing. It's the yin and yang character.
I still highly favor the read that originally Yahweh was kind of antagonistic towards the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they kind of like follow that in tradition with the whole wrestles with God thing.
Yes.
Arguing
like
with
Jacob. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that that still seems to be the most likely original intended scenario, given everything I've heard, is that the first couple stories are about man trying to reach godhood and God slapping them down, not because there's something inherently wrong with that, but because God was like, no, that's mine.
Yeah. Well, if you look at it like this, imagine this world, okay? I want you to think about the best possible case scenario of the world, and I want you to think about the worst possible case scenario of the world. It's what humans do. It's the determinism and humanism, whatever. Take it to its nth degree. I would say that the worst case scenario would be something like Stalin and Hitler that are absolutely massacring people, okay, just because of their race or whatever, like millions of people are being massacred. I see that as like, ugh, you know, it's gross and evil. Or pedophilia, like, you know, where people are taking advantage of children in a sexual way and destroying them. This, like, that's most evil. And then the best possible case scenario would be, you know, you have a perfectly healthy life and you live free of pain and cancer and things like that. That could be a really positive thing for humans, I assume.
Get about 90, have a nice family, retire well, get to 90 and then like get hit by a bus.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have to worry about it. And sorry if this is gross, I'm not going to say it. So if you have, but if you, you know, I was going to say in you're 90 and still physically active, you know, like wink, wink, nudge, nudge with his wife. Okay, so that would be the best case scenario for some
people. Do you think Alan Bondar has like problems with God because maybe of his Calvinistic roots?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't think, I think that probably Reformed theology had the most power on him. If you watch the intro to his show,
yeah,
he's like, you were a maggot, you were a worm, you were nothing without Jesus, and then you get saved, and then guess what? You're still a maggot and you're still a worm. That's Reformed theology.
Yeah.
So that bothers him tremendously. But he didn't leave it. He just suddenly woke up in his mind. He's like, this is all garbage. I'm not going to believe it anymore. And he just stepped away.
I just mean, like, from what I've been listening, like, I've listened to part two and part three of your rounds.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, the way he tries to corner you about God allowing pedophilia, doesn't that mean he's condoning pedophilia or something?
I feel like
it has to do with a Calvinistic mindset, perhaps.
His approach is very simple. He's like, look, if God is omniscient, omnipresent, all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good, then that means that he should be the same in every single economy because he does not change. By economy, I mean every age that's in the Bible. So if you go to a tribal warfare time where you've got the Israelites who are in their 40-year journey and they're fighting like the Amorites and everybody, right? And then in Deuteronomy, it says, and if you see... If you kill this man and he leaves behind a wife, you can take her as a wife. But if you end up not liking her, you can let her go.
Yeah.
So in other words, he's like, you can have sex with this foreign woman, but if you don't like it, you can let her go. Right. And he's like, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
And so therefore, he sees God as immoral. And so he's like, but also what I'm trying to show him in the Matrix is that he is judging him based on the age in which he lives. Like you're judging that, but he's saying, no. If he's all knowing, all powerful and all this, then he should make these decisions. And I'm like, yes. But if you keep listening to what I said about when God limits himself for purpose through mediation and through relationship, I can show you what's going on. You're going to find out that it's the men, it's the mediators that are writing this down. It's the mediators that are teaching this. Jesus gives us the hermeneutic. Jesus actually gives you the hermeneutic. You want me to show you how he does it?
Go ahead.
All right, watch this. The Pharisees come up and say, Moses gave us the right to have a divorce. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Go back and read it. It's God saying it. It's not Moses.
Okay.
Moses is the mediator of the Torah.
Yeah.
He's the mediator of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Moses is dealing with people in their time in specific ways. And if you really pay close attention, all of the things that he's mediating are actually better than any surrounding tribe, anything that's going on in the ancient Near East. It's always a level up. I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I'm saying that it's what he decides. He says, you have to shave her head and she cannot be touched for 30 days. And then if you want her, you can bring her in. If you do not want her, you have to set her free. You can't sell her.
Different then.
Back then, Yeah. You didn't set anybody free. If you didn't want her, you just mistreated her and sold her. He says, no, you can't do that. She is now a free person.
People got stoned
that could be for bad, though.
Committing adultery.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, like you got stoned for a lot of things in the Old Testament.
But
he did, yeah.
But he, you know, Alan is not the only one that has said this to me. I've had many, many atheists. You know, you think, you know, Andy has just said, I don't talk about it because I don't want to really get into that.
And, well, yeah, honestly, it just feels like it feels like I believe it. I don't know his take on it. I'm not speaking to his take on it. But,
sure.
But it sounds like a similar, you know, a similar irreconcilable dilemma that I have with if you have an all-knowing good God and evil, like how does that work? Mm-hmm. That's the question. Right.
Yep. And that's what his question is. It's like, how can he be good if all of these things happen and he's endorsing it or condoning it?
He can,
like pedophilia.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I mean, just like why? Like why? Why does that exist?
Yeah.
He made us. Why does that exist? Why is that a possibility in the machine?
Well, and you have to ask the question. That's why I believe in the liberty of humanity.
Oh, but how do you have, you can't have, I'm so sorry. You can't have liberty with an all-knowing being, they are mutually exclusive.
Only, again,
unless he limits himself, which feels like something it feels like the cosmological constant or dark matter. It's so a placeholder for a real idea that doesn't exist.
Would you be a Calvinist?
But
I'm totally a determinist.
but that's the point. That's the point. To say, well, that seems like a terrible argument. Like, so a lot of Christians would look at me and say, no, Rick, that's terrible. God doesn't limit himself, right? I'm saying, wrong. The Bible shows that he's limiting himself all of the time.
Oh, I agree.
Only
that,
in relationship to
that,
a finite creation.
That God changes if you
But what yeah, God does, yeah. God play. So just think about the fact that he put the tree in the garden to start with. He put it in the garden to start with.
Chekhov's apple.
But that's the thing. It's there. Yeah, he's put it in the garden. So who is responsible ultimately? Well, it's man's responsible. It's like, well, God put it there. Yeah. But what about what about the serpent character? Why is he allowed to be there? Why is he allowed to be the one to deceive? What's the point? People could ask the same question about Job, right?
Yeah.
Think about Job. In the book of Job, all of the angels or the divine council meet, and this Satan character, it's raining outside. Yeah, if they won't be able to hear, but we can. But the Satan character shows up, and what does God say? Where have you been? I've been on the earth, going to and fro on it. Okay. Then God opens up the thing. Have you considered my servant Job? He is righteous.
Oh yeah, this. Oh yeah, Lord, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, this adversary character is obviously in the throne room.
Mm-hmm. So he's why up is he there. Who puts him there?
Why is he there? Who made him? How did he get there? It's not like it's a big surprise. He has a function. This is a functionary being.
Yeah.
And God is using his function for his purposes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, we can argue and say, I don't like that.
Well, what is the function?
The function, that he allows that functionary being to kill all of his children. I'll never forget, Andy uses the word that's bitter sugar. I'll never forget when you said that. You said it in regard to this. I said, after, you know, he kills all of his kids, and then he puts boils on him and, like, puts him through a lot of hell. And then at the very end of the book, he gives his kids back. Like, he gets new kids.
New kids.
And you're like, it's kind of bitter sugar. It's like, you killed my other ones, and now you gave me more, you know?
I think anybody with a child—
The whole point was—
Yeah, just think about that.
The adversary—
Think about somebody killing your children, then, to be like, here's a couple more.
Yeah, like if—
No,
like
you
if somebody,
missed the point,
if somebody,
sir.
If somebody came and killed Katie and Jonas, and then 10 years later, I got new kids, and I'm going to be like, oh, that's awesome. No.
No, you those can be isolated incidents. I love these new kids.
Yes.
That doesn't change the first part.
The fact that those were killed, yeah. You know, and then for us, in our minds, we have to make it out like, well, I guess those kids were being evil and doing wrong, so they deserve death. That's what they'll try to say.
But
the Bible
doesn't talk
about that.
Why can they do evil?
It doesn't talk about that.
Why is that an option? Even if you say God limits himself, when did he limit himself?
Mm-hmm.
He limited himself before he made morality, but he couldn't have because there's things that are not included in the possibility space of human behavior, like roughly.
All right. If God...
Like, so there was some, there is some limiting on human behavior, just in completely esoteric ways.
Sure.
So it's like, so when did the self-limiting happen? Did he self-limited before he made man? And to what extent? How do you make those choices? Like, it just gets absurd immediately.
Yeah, I understand. So think about it. So here you go. We can look at it as absurd, or you can see, like, when did he limit himself? The moment he created a being is when he limited himself.
Before?
The moment he made him. The moment he made the being, he's limited himself. Why? Here's how I know. If he has to eat of something in order to become like...
They probably... I apologize. You probably will hear this rain.
If you guys hear rain, we're getting a lot of rain.
Yeah, it's real loud. Okay.
So the minute that God made a thing, he limited himself. It's immediate. Because he's made a thing.
So he's no longer all-knowing.
Oh, if he decides to do that. It's like
okay, so but what I'm saying is, how did he choose how to make man?
All right.
Like here we go. Where do those decisions come from? Is he limited when he's making the possible morality of man? Does he first go, maybe I need to forget what horrible things could happen so that I can accidentally make them? Is that what we're talking? It doesn't make any sense.
I'm gonna do my best.
All right.
I'm gonna try my best. You ready?
All right. Now you got it from two. Okay.
So here we go.
Sorry.
Yeah, we got sidetracked. Are you enjoying this, Kirsten?
I'm just chilling.
You know, okay, so here it's
hanging out.
Just chilling. So here it is. God makes a man. Then he begins to observe the man.
Mm-hmm.
At this stage, that man is not like God. Mm-hmm. According to the Bible, he hasn't eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and therefore had his eyes open and become like God, seeing both good and evil.
Right.
So he has limited himself.
He's like a beast, basically.
He's relating to a beast.
Yeah.
Thank you. Fine. Say it that way.
Yeah.
He's relating to a dumb animal. And this is not working because this animal is feeling lonely. This animal sees everything else, birds, fish, animals, all these procreating and having family. He is not. God has limited himself already just by making the man without him being like him. That's a limitation.
But that's not God limiting himself. That's God limiting Adam.
Because but he's relating to him. So therefore it's limiting.
He's relating to him because in the story, he's not completely all powerful and omnipotent. That's just not, there's other gods. There's a council of gods and devils and stuff to Nephilim to be accounted for. It's an older creation myth that we've lost a lot of, but not entirely. You know what I mean?
I know what you're saying.
You don't need him to limit him. He can just have been not all-knowing or not moral.
Yeah.
He can be one or two of those things.
But the structure of the Bible makes it difficult because later it tells you that he is.
That's the problem. Yes.
Okay, so that's
exactly the problem.
So then once it gets introduced later, then you find out it's an attribute that God had and he's always had it. And so if it says that, then you go back, you have to reinterpret the story
that's
again.
That's right. Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's what we're forced with. This is a constant.
Well, that's right. That's the battle.
It's a constant
tension.
Yeah. Every time you learn something new, you have to reinterpret it.
Yeah.
Every time. That's why Bondar called it a puzzle. That's why he said he loved the Bible because it was a massive puzzle.
So What do you use to come to the idea that God limited himself? Where do you get that? Is it just that's contextual or does that come from somewhere else?
I think it's a combination between textual and philosophical.
Okay.
So textually speaking, he limits himself because he says, where are you, Adam?
Okay. So there's no point in the Bible that's like, and God made himself a little dumber so that he could hang out with people and not be frustrated.
No, you learn it through revelation over time.
Okay.
And by revelation, meaning throughout the Bible, contextually, then you pick it up and then you find that what these attributes are.
Okay.
That's it. If you read it directly, like if I read Genesis 1, he's fine.
I'm going to like.
Greg's not happy about the storm. Yeah. So anyway, if we that I guess the issue here is that when you learn something about this God in its, you know, in its infancy, when you first learn it at the beginning of the story, as with anything, the story grows, and as it grows, it becomes more rich over time. You know, it's like I was telling Alan Bondar. He's writing his book, and he's using other Christians as test pieces to see if his theories are working. And the ones that aren't working, he goes back and rewrites his book. He just told me yesterday, Rick, I've got chapters that are based on you. My argument with him, right? Because he's like, I'm going to help you get out of Christianity. Oh, and Lord. Now I'm, but what I'm saying is that.
God bless you, Alan, if you hear this. I just can't imagine, I can't imagine putting
taking
forth
that much
sort of,
effort.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, he's rewrote that book for like 2 years.
Rick seems pretty cool. I think he's going to do fine.
But yeah, but he says, but what he ends up saying, what I tried to show him like in reverse is like, dude, you are literally learning from me and rewriting your narrative of your magnum opus.
Sure.
And you're a human being and you don't believe in God. I'm telling you that God does the same thing, but on a mass scale with humanity. That's all I'm saying.
But still implies a lack of omnipotence.
Because he limits himself and the Bible reveals that he does.
Yeah, but you're kind of writing that into the Bible because it's necessary to believe the things you want to believe.
Who I am or they are?
You are.
No, I'm not writing it in.
Yeah, it says, and thus God chose to be less smart and powerful than he could have otherwise been.
It shows it in action.
Right. That's what I mean. Like,
yeah. So you have to, determining it based
on. You're having to create that reality out of the context, right? It's not explicitly anywhere in the Bible, even as quickly as some of the other things. What was that one that's like so fast? The one about choice, exception or whatever. It's like one word. It gets flown over, and all of Calvinism is based on
election.
It's not even election. It's not even as strong as the verse on election, which is by my standards incredibly weak. It seems like something that gets tripped over on the way somewhere else, right? It doesn't even that to me. That's weak.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
and that's there. That's in the text. It still just like seems like it's an aside.
Mm-hmm. So. I always thought of an aside is when it says he made the stars also.
Yeah. Well, that too.
Go. What were you about to ask?
I forget.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, back to you.
Those are the conversations I try not to have.
You're fine, Andy. It's your birthday.
Yeah. Woo. Yes. For my
that's
birthday.
That's what you wanted to do.
Exactly.
I know.
We should all take him out for a beer. Jeez.
I was like,
I told him we would, but he was like, I told him we'd take him out to dinner.
I told him, totally.
I told my mom I would go over after this just to bring over trash, which is not like a thing I could not do.
Yeah.
But I take my trash over to my mom's house and it gets picked up there. And I can't go tomorrow.
Well, we're going to wrap this up in about 10 minutes anyway.
Very exciting. You guys want to know more about how I deal with trash? It's real. Man. The minutiae, so good.
You know what you should do?
What's that?
You should just take it and put it in my dumpster. It's just right on Howard Gap Road.
Oh.
I don't care.
I don't know where that is. I know where Howard Gap.
I will give you my address and you go through it in my dumpster. I've got one of those monster dumpsters and we're never more than half full. I'm not giving the address on this podcast because
it's like pessimistic about trash.
Yeah.
What's your favorite food, Andy?
It's half full, bud.
Oh, Lord. That's hard. I'd say lately it's been mac and cheese. Good mac and cheese.
We could take you out for some mac and cheese.
But, jeez.
But sometimes it's literally a salad. I don't know, you know? Yeah. I like the extremes.
Yes. All right. What you got now, Kirsten? What
else? Okay. So I want to wrap up the biblical storyline narrative thing.
Go ahead.
And I want to include eternal conscious torment and election and everything. So drawing back from the Old Testament, Jesus came to restore the kingdom that God divided in the Old Testament. And of course, you know, there's an extension of grace to us today, but he came to fulfill those promises. And I believe a part of those promises was the Old Covenant wrath, if that makes sense. The Deuteronomy curses.
Yes.
Okay, so Old Covenant Israel, Judah, in the first century, they were being disobedient, obviously. And Jesus calls them out, and that's why he brings wrath in 70 AD. That's the whole point of the second coming, is to bring wrath. Of course, we take it fulfilled because it is.
This rain is bringing wrath right now.
Yeah, man.
We're disobedient.
So
if it does this for 40 days, we're toast.
God knew the atheist was going to talk a lot. He was like, let's drown this out.
I totally believe that the eternal conscious torment thing, I believe in the scriptures, it's really just the 70 AD wrath. It's not eternal conscious torment. Isn't that what you believe?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I think we take it as eternal conscious torment because of judgment and apocalyptic language.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand the arguments of like, oh, well, everlasting fire, and then the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. But I believe Jesus came and he brought wrath on the first century people that were disobedient. And I believe the elect were saved. They did not. I believe
they left Jerusalem.
Yes, because they heeded Jesus Christ's words in Matthew 24.
And fled.
And that showed their faith, and they fled the physical wrath.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the Deuteronomy 28 and 29 curses, okay, it doesn't say anything about eternal conscious torment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to tell the audience today, is that it doesn't say anything about that. It's talking about land curses, like I will bring pestilence if you are disobedient. So it's the blessings and the cursings. If you are obedient, you will get the blessings. If you are disobedient, you will get the cursings. Well, the cursings has nothing to do with eternal conscious torment. It's I will bring pestilence, I will bring famine, I will bring a nation, a foreign nation, to come against this land, take you into captivity and scatter you. And then I'll regather you later on.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have mercy on you. And that is what happened in the first century. I mean, Jesus was fulfilling the Old Testament. You know, he's fulfilling everything, if that makes sense. Don't you agree with that?
I often wonder, like, first of all, I think it's the ultimate fulfillment.
That's what I mean.
The total fulfillment. Things were fulfilled. A lot of the things that were supposed to be fulfilled were. And then you see, like, where it's almost like it advances the fulfillment. It's the total fulfillment. It caps the fulfillment.
Yeah. Of the Old Testament.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
Yes.
So,
I agree.
Yeah. And I think the wrath, so I've been doing like a wrath study, and I've been going through the book of Acts, and we'll wrap this up. But I went through the book of Acts, which the Apostle Paul, like, I listened to Daniel Anthony, and I think this is an awesome point. He's the first person who really pointed this out, is the Apostle Paul. So he is called to preach the gospel, but he says nothing and is totally silent in all of his epistles and in the book of Acts about eternal conscious torment.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't say a word. And if that's a part of the gospel, it's a part of the American gospel today that we preach in America.
Right.
Jesus died to deliver you from eternal conscious torment, so you wouldn't go to hell after you die. So if that was a part...
Yeah, why didn't Paul say it?
So why didn't Paul say it one time?
Right.
He is, like, besides Jesus, he is, like, the number one gospel preacher. That was God's
He's
man.
He's the mediator of the new covenant to the Gentiles.
Yeah, the Apostle Paul, that was God's special calling on him. He was God's... Besides Jesus, he was God's number one gospel preacher. That was his calling. And if that is your calling, somewhere in the New Testament, there has to be a hint of eternal conscious torment. I feel like that's important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're preaching the gospel, you're going to want to include that. I feel like that's one of the most important things. And it is in America today. So why doesn't he mention it?
Yeah.
He mentions the word wrath and he mentions the word judgment. But I think we have corrupted our understanding of what judgment is, and I think we think it's eternal conscious torment, but nowhere in the New Testament says that.
Right.
So what is judgment and what is wrath? And we have to go back and look at those things.
Whenever people bring up Luke 16, Luke 16 always will. Yeah.
Tom Mills keeps doing that to me.
Yeah, well, tell them that the five sons are the five sons of Ananias. Five sons, do you know what I'm talking about?
I know the five sons in the story.
So Caiaphas is the high priest at the time that Jesus is telling this story.
Okay.
I believe that the man that's in the fire that's looking up is being represented as Caiaphas, even though Caiaphas wasn't in the actual judgment of Jerusalem. He was already dead. But when he's telling the story, Caiaphas is the high priest. He's a man that's rich, that's clothed in purple and fine linen.
Yes, and that's another thing we want to zoom in on is why is the rich man clothed in purple?
Because he's a high priest.
Right.
And not only that, he says, I have five brothers, go and tell them. And what does he say? Abraham says, no, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he says, no, Father Abraham, send someone back from the dead. And he says, even if I send someone back from the dead, they will not listen. Right?
So Tom Mills'
argument. Those five brothers are the five sons of Ananias. His father-in-law was Ananias, who was the high priest whenever Jesus was born.
Right.
The house of Ananias is a wicked, wicked priesthood. It's horrible.
See, I've never heard that. I always went with the five brothers were the brothers of Judah. When you go back to Genesis and the tribes, Judah has five brothers and sisters by the same mother.
Yes.
That's how I took it. But mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Caiaphas is the brother-in-law of the five sons of Ananias.
Right.
Those are the high priests that, and by the way, Ananias' sons, all five of them become the high priest. And it's important to note, King Herod is an Edomian. He's an Edomite.
Mm-hmm.
They are the hated ones from Esau. Okay. Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. The Edomites that descend from Esau, they become the Edomians. That's who Herod is.
Right.
Herod is an Edomian. He was put in power by the Romans.
Yeah. So Tom Mills' argument is always, why would Jesus bring this parable up and talk about that it's talking about after death? So how would you combat that?
Because he's using their own belief system and showing them how they're the ones that are going to be tortured. They were using Greek and this Hellenistic theory of after death torture.
Right.
On the people of Israel. They were teaching it. The Old Covenant, the Old Testament doesn't talk about a fiery torment after death.
That's correct. It's completely silent.
So if Jesus is who he says he is, then he's obviously using the teachings that they're using on the people and turning it on them and saying, actually, you're teaching these people that they're going to burn in hell after they die. You're the ones that are going to burn.
That's correct.
And where's the lake? Where's the lake of fire? See, some people put it in some spiritual place. The lake of fire is inside the walls of Jerusalem when it burnt.
It was back in 70 AD.
Yes.
It burnt to the ground.
And death and Hades were swallowed in it.
Yeah.
The end.
Death. I believe people want to take lake of fire as a literal lake of fire, but the book of Revelation is so packed with imagery and symbolic imagery.
It's clear what that all-consuming fire, who is God, that lake of fire is the second death. That second death, that is where death and Hades are cast into. That is where Satan is cast into. That is where the false prophet is cast into. All of it goes there. And then it's done.
Now, what would you say about, in Matthew 25, the separation of the sheep and the goats?
It took place. It already happened.
They were cast into everlasting fire.
It happened. Who were the goats? They were the ones that were clothed in purple and fine linen and weren't taking care of Lazarus.
And who were the sheep? The elect.
The Lazaruses that were longing and needing, but were giving things of themselves to others. Those were the ones that Jesus said that would enter into Abraham's bosom, that would go into the paradise.
And the Pharisees thought that was complete blasphemy.
The Old Covenant doesn't talk about Abraham's bosom either.
No, it does not.
So is Jesus suddenly creating some new teaching?
Right.
No, he's using their teaching against them to show them. It's a prophetic parable of mercy.
Yeah.
That's what I call it.
Yeah, I believe the rich man who was suffering in the flame, I just believe that was the 70 AD judgment.
Yes.
Jesus said—
He's showing them ahead of time before it happens.
Yeah, it was a prophetic warning.
Now,
this is what's going to happen to
why
you.
Why do you think he used the name Lazarus?
Eliezer?
He used Lazarus because they know— The priests know who Lazarus is. Why? Because after he resurrected the actual Lazarus from the dead, they wanted to murder him.
Right.
It says they put a death warrant on him.
So you think it's the same Lazarus?
I think I don't think that it's the self-same Lazarus that went to Abraham.
Right.
I think it's the representation of a resurrected person. Because what does he say? Remember when he resurrects Lazarus? Right before he does it, in John chapter 11, they say, well, if he's asleep, then he's going to be fine. He's like, no, Lazarus is dead. Right?
Right.
Well, it's set, and he says, and I'm glad that this happened so that you may believe. Now listen closely. Go to Luke 16 and think about what Abraham told the rich man. He said, even if you bring somebody back from the dead, they're not going to believe.
Right.
That's exactly what the priest did.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Right.
So, and by the way, the only time you read that is in the book of Luke. And who is Luke written to?
Jews?
Theophilus.
Oh, Theophilus.
Who's Theophilus? Do you know who he is?
No.
He's the son of Annas.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Theophilus ben Annas.
Hmm.
Yeah.
See, that's good. You know your history, and mm-hmm. it's good to... that.
Josephus is the one that tells you who the five sons are.
Right.
And one of them is Theophilus ben Annas. That's right.
That's awesome.
Yeah, man.
It's good to know your background.
Mm-hmm.
Not
so
just,
when you think, like, who is he writing to?
Yeah.
Theophilus. People are like, well, it's a friend of God is what it means. No, it was an actual person. He was writing these books to an actual person who was a high priest. And by the way, when he writes the first book, he is high priest at the time. And when he writes the second book, he's no longer high priest. And I can prove it just in the book itself. Because he says, these things that I have written to you, right?
Yeah.
Most excellent, Theophilus. And the second one, he says, oh, Theophilus.
In Acts, right?
He leaves out most excellent. The reason why is because he's no longer in the most excellent position, which is the high priesthood.
That's awesome. You know that background information. That's so useful.
So tell Tom Mills to just start reading some Josephus. I'm sure he has. Tom Mills is a brilliant dude, by the way. I've seen a lot of his arguments. He's a very smart guy. But he's also, you know, he's really heavy on the rapture. In the first century.
One last question is...
I think that's what I'm thinking of.
If the rich man is in eternal conscious torment after death, why is he talking?
Why does he only want one drop of water?
You know, if you're in so much agony, how are you able
to? He does. He was like, I just want one drop of water on my tongue because I'm in this torment. It's obvious that this isn't real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a metaphor.
Jesus is using their stories against them to say, this is ridiculous. Our testaments... our writings do not discuss this.
Yeah, nothing in the Old Testament. You will never find anything.
Ever. You will never find any after-death fire in the Old Testament.
But you know what you will find? The term, the fire that does not quench. And you know what it means every single time?
Yes. Go ahead.
National judgment.
And the fire that will not... yeah. If you look at Sodom and Gomorrah, Jude talks about it. That the smoke goes up forever and ever.
But it's not still burning.
Dude, go to Sodom and Gomorrah right now. It's not burning. Some people think that it is. I've heard people say there's still smoke coming up from there. It's like, you know, whatever.
Yeah, so
Craig Olson, who was an archaeologist, has been there, and he said the smoke's not happening. And he's an actual archaeologist. He was on our show.
Yeah,
he's like, it's not smoking anymore.
You also see it in Isaiah 34, and you can see it a few verses down, like maybe 6, 7, and 8. It talks about burning, the rivers turning into burning pitch and a fire that... goes up day and night forever and ever. And it uses that same kind of language in Revelation. And it's talking about the nation of Edom. But if you go to that nation today, there's no fire burning there.
Right.
It's just ruins. It mm-hmm. just means, you know, that's it.
Dude, all it is that it's reading the Bible with a very literal perspective on it. And then the differences are like understanding what is actually symbolic and what is literal. And it seems like futurism and preterism are flip-flopped.
They are.
Things that are symbolic, but it's really weird how they pull the symbology out of it. It's like you'll read an entire symbolic book, and then they'll see 1,000 years, and they're like, that's literal.
But you know, like, what I really want?
Why would you say that's literal? If everything, you just saw a beast with 10 horns on its head come out of the sea, is that going to happen? Well, that's representation of Rome. Oh, well, then why 1,000 years? That's literal. Why? Like, why did that suddenly become literal?
But what you have to do is you really have to be familiar with the Old Testament if you want to interpret the New Testament. And we can wrap up.
Yeah. No, I was just looking at my watch because I told him I was going to be done in 10 and it's been 16.
So yeah, eternal conscious torment after death is not real.
No. And if you don't believe me, then read Edward Fudge, and you can also...
That is an awesome movie.
What?
The Edward Fudge movie. Have you seen it?
I haven't, no.
Oh, yeah. It's for free on YouTube. Michael Miano, he mentioned it, and then I watched it for free. It's really good.
Oh, okay. I'll have to check it out.
Edward Fudge, it shows his story about him going to college and debating different people.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
About it, yeah.
Well, Andy, I'm glad you got to hear about, Calvinism, election, fire, and all the things.
The lack of eternal conscious torment.
And so Rick and I do not believe that election, we believe election is biblical, absolutely, but we don't believe that it's for today.
I think it's biblical, necessary, and happened and proven. And where I stand today, I believe, I'm really leaning heavily towards liberty and choice in
absolutely.
The new covenant world.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I'm not 100% right on everything, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I will probably be dashed against the wall for this one, but it's okay. I mean, this is, I can write it all down for you if you guys really want to know why I think this, and if I'm mistaken, feel free. I'm pretty sure I'll be getting comments. I always do. So.
Yeah, we're heretics.
Everybody's a heretic to somebody else.
I love always. Michael Miano's thing, heretics.
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 I love that.
That's funny. Yeah. Well, Kirsten and I have really had a good time with you here.
Yeah.
You have to come back.
It was good to see you again.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll have to move up here
sorry
and be here all the time.
We've definitely confused you, Andy. I'm sorry.
Nah, he's not confused at all.
No. I mean, there's a lot of stuff where you guys are talking in a manner that requires a base level knowledge that I don't have. So there's times where I'm just like, that's how it works. Sometimes it's fine. You guys aren't here for me. But there's times when you guys are just talking about stuff where I'm just like,
just so you know, if I ever like, it's kind of how, like when I have Andy as a sound man because I don't understand the way things work with sound and recording and stuff. And I do my own stuff and it's never the quality that I want. It sucks. And I'm always like, oh, I just wish Andy would come over here and show me how to do this. But when I sit down and I talk to Andy about sound, if he starts talking to me about things, like he'll say, well, it's 20 lufs and blah, blah, blah. And now I'm like, yeah, it's all Greek to me.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I don't need to know it. I just need Andy to know it, so that's good. Andy, I appreciate you, bro.
Oh, thank
Happy
you,
birthday again.
Yay. Happy birthday.
We got to talk
Andy.
About hell on your birthday. All right.
Yay. All right.
So exciting.
All right. Well, if you guys want, you can send an email to rick@burrowsofberea.com or rocketman@burrowsofberea.com, or you can go to bigdaddy@burrowsofberea.com. You can go to theedge@burrowsofberea.com. These are all these people. So feel free to send all of your comments there.
Yeah.
You can also send it
maybe I'll finally get some hate mail.
Yeah. We have burrowsofberea@gmail.com as well. You can go to info@burrowsofberea.com.
People get really upset when you say hell's not real.
Yeah, isn't it weird?
It's like almost they need it to be real.
That's one of the things that Rick Carter says to me so much. He's like, when I came to the idea of universalism and I really saw it and I couldn't unsee it, he said, I was so happy. And the minute I told everybody, like, did you know that God's not going to punish anybody? That's how awesome God was, that Jesus settled it for everybody, even though I disagree with him. For him, that was such a beautiful thing. The minute he told people, they were like, get out of my face. God doesn't love anybody that much. And he's like,
yeah,
it's weird. It's
I've had
wild.
People get angry because I don't believe that. And it's like, I have freedom to believe that. Just
like,
calm down.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go to hell because I don't.
If you believe in it so much, why are you not knocking on everybody's door every day?
That is
Tell
exactly.
You're like, well, if you believe it that much, then you need to be knocking on some doors and stop waiting on everybody else to do it for you.
I love you right now because I have that same mindset.
It's like,
I've been
get
thinking
busy, pal.
That if you really believe in hell, why are you not knocking down
stop
every
blaming
door?
Everybody else for not getting out there and doing your job. You need to be spreading the gospel more than anybody.
Every sermon needs to be about hell because this is horrible.
Yes. It's forever.
It's eternal.
You can preach
conscious
a sermon
torment.
On hell for the rest of your life and be doing the perfect will if that's what you believe, because you're saving people from whatever you think that's happening. Yeah, man. Jesus did. Jesus preached on hell more than anybody in the New Testament, but that hell was Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom.
Yeah, did he ever use the word hell?
Gehenna, no. The word hell is a construct word in English. We need to end this. We could do this all night.
Sorry.
All right, we'll talk to you guys again next time. Y'all can go straight to Gehenna.
Nice.
Outside of Jerusalem.
We'll talk to you guys again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Bye.
You ever make something so good, people start interrogating you like, what's in this?
Did you make this from scratch? Where did you learn to cook like that? And I just smile because deep down, I know the truth. I didn't level up my skills. I leveled up my seasoning. It's called my secret ingredient. Let's start with the MVP. Everything. This blend? It's the Thor of the spice rack. Chicken. Glorious. Roasted veggies? I ate those on purpose. Yes, I sprinkled it on popcorn and suddenly became everyone's favorite movie host. And to be honest with you, I might have even tried it on possum. Yeehaw! Do I regret it? Of course. But only because I didn't notice that the tail was still on it. Rookie mistake. Everything just works. It's like confidence in a jar. Shake it on, and suddenly you're plating like you're on a cooking show without breaking a sweat. Then there's Steakhouse. This one's bold, smoky, and, like me, a bit dramatic. It makes burgers taste like they've been grilled by someone with strong opinions and great taste. I've used it on steak, mushrooms, even sweet potato fries. And every single time someone says, wait, did you marinate this for, what, 48 hours? Nope, just shook it on, flipped it, and took all the credit. Last week, my cousin asked me for a recipe, and I said, sure, I'll leave it to you in my will. So if you want to rule the kitchen without lifting a finger, go to mysecretblends.com. That's mysecretblends.com. And don't forget to use code BURROWS for 20% off your first order. Shake it. Serve it. Smile sweetly when they ask and say, shh, it's my secret.